you aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch. You must be a witch.
Hello to the Missing Witches Coven and happy Flower Moon. It's your Auntie Amy, and today we'll be chatting with a nurse, witch, and self-described anarcho-herbalist, Ravi. After we spoke, Ravi sent me a ton of links and information, so please check out the show notes for this episode. They are jam-packed. But one of the things that Ravi sent me was a little bit of a distillation on their feelings on the general subject, so I'm going to read that to you now by way of introduction. Ravi wrote, "As nurses were one-time witches, I personally feel that holistic nursing is the closest I have come to actually practicing witchcraft and the art of healing. Holistic nursing does not banish CAM, and sorry, I'll just interrupt there for a second. For those of you who don't know what CAM is, it's a healthcare acronym for complementary and alternative medicine. Okay, back to Ravi. Holistic nursing does not banish CAM from its purview, but rather embraces it as a part of nursing heritage and continuously massages the entrenched Western healthcare delivery systems into accepting and integrating those often forgotten aspects of healing. For example, I get peer-reviewed publications each month from the AHNA describing how practices like Reiki, prayer, energy fieldwork, and yoga are all within the scope of nursing practice. In my current workplace, we have aromatherapy oils that we offer to patients with anxiety, nausea, or other complaints. We have a smudge room in the hospital for Indigenous families to burn sage together. There are mounds of research about how nurses can use herbalism in their practice, both in and out of settings like hospitals. In a world that keeps trying to shut the door on these spiritually charged modes of healing that connect us to earth and to each other, the field of nursing, and specifically holistic nursing, is compassionately holding that link to our ancestors strong. Nursing appreciates and honors traditional modes of healing that patients bring with them to their meetings and works with the client patient to integrate these very important and culturally based perspectives into their healing journey. Nurses also know that the best healer is the client-patient themselves, and educate to empower that individual to make choices that are the best for them. All these things, believe it or not, are also witchcraft." So if Ravi's introduction sparks some interest for you, please sit back and enjoy our conversation. Happy full moon, babes. Happy full moon.
Happy full moon to you.
It's the flower moon, so I thought you would be a perfect guest for this. I'll let you introduce yourself to our listeners, Ravi. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. My Sanskrit name is Ravi Dev Priyakar, and flower moon is one of my very favorite of the full moons, although I have to confess that I do love all of them.
You gotta love a full moon. So who are you? Who are you? What are you doing?
Oh man, what am I doing? That's a really good question. What am I doing with my life? So I guess that I'm a collection of a lot of different things that I found that I like. I'm a nurse. I'm a witch. I am a yoga teacher. I also just recently got a certification to teach something called Ula One, which is a really cool yoga-inspired dance kind of class. I'm an activist and a gardener, and I guess explorer is a good word. I just kind of keep collecting little identities as I go. I'm an amalgamation of the different things I found in my life that I enjoy.
And one of the larger focuses that I've seen from you is herbalism.
Yes.
So yes. I know that you're into plant medicine, but like in your childhood attractions, which came first, like healing or plants?
Definitely plants. I do identify as an herbalist, and I'm mostly self-studied. It kind of came along with the medical route that I took, which was circuitously brought me around towards nursing. But whenever I was a kid, we were always outside constantly. And we would take these long family backpacking trips through Appalachia. And we were always looking up the names of the plants and taking pictures of flowers. And My parents even would make us close our eyes and touch the bark of a tree and have us tell them what kind of tree it was just based on the way it felt. So I have had a very immersive introduction to not only plants, but also earth and how, living with the earth and what works and what doesn't work. And that goes into other things too, like responsible hunting and just a whole plethora of ecological sort of learning the whole time I grew up. And I have always loved plants, always loved them. And I remember even like up to my adulthood, like whenever we had to pull up the weeds, like I was like, why does that one have to be called a weed? Why, what's wrong with it? Why doesn't it get to stay? And if my mom had to thin out some plants, I would cry because those plants didn't get to make it to their adulthood and realize their potential. Like, yeah.
I
Yes.
remember asking my mother too, who decided which ones were weeds?
Yeah, my daughter actually got me a t-shirt that says dandelions are flowers too. Cuz that's my big activist port here in Montana. People hate dandelions with such a ferocity that it really baffles me. And I'm always like, but why? And they're like, because they get in the way of my green lawn and it mars the landscape. And I'm just like, dude.
My utterly useless
I
green
know.
grass lawn.
Like, what do? You look at
Yeah,
it?
it's a
Yeah.
very like a settler mentality of like
Oh my
everything has to be
God.
uniform and precise and.
And under control and how they want it to be. Oh my God. I have always just instinctively rebelled against that. And so I find a great ally in dandelions for that reason, is they will not give up. But also just in general, like they're the coolest plant. They're the one of the first ones that comes up in the spring. Their whole body is medicine, like all throughout the season, every part of them. All they want to do is make you happy.
Can you break that down for our listeners? Every part of them is medicine. Can you break that
Yeah.
down?
Yeah. So with plant medicine, there are different ways to allow yourself with the plant and to utilize what the plant has to offer. And sometimes it's the root, sometimes it's the leaf, sometimes it's the flower or the seed. The root part is the part below ground, and then the aerial part is the part above the ground. And with dandelions, for instance, the root is something that you could harvest in the before the leaves come out in this very early spring or in the late fall after it's gone to seed. And the medicine has all gone down into the roots because that's where all the energy and the sugar of the plant has gone down to sleep. And then in the spring, when the first leaves come up, they are using all of that stored energy, and they are the part of the plant that has the most potency. Whenever the first flower comes up, then that flower is where all the life is as well. So as the plant goes through its season and as the world sort of turns around it, there's different ways to utilize the different parts of a plant. The root is a particular kind of medicine. It's very good for flushing your lymph system, and it's very cleansing and supportive. The leaves have an amazing amount of vitamins and minerals and also detoxifying things. So after a whole winter of having to live off of whatever you stored as potatoes or beans or these very stagnating type of habits that we have, then it helps to like brighten everything up, and it flushes your system and gives you a bunch of vitamin C just in time to make sure that you don't get sick. And then the flowers similarly have their own set of things to offer. And it's just all, it kind of reminds me of something that I started to notice, especially in Montana. It's a very interesting ecosystem. And if there is something that the environment might cause to happen, then there's a plant that can heal it. So we get these horribly long winters. I say horribly, and I should acknowledge that I do love the winter. They're very long here. So it's
I
still
live
work.
in northern Quebec, so yeah, I
Yes.
can relate to the horribly
Yes.
long winter. It's like 7 months
It's
sometimes,
so
it
it's
feels
really
like.
long. Oh my God, last year, I don't know how y'all's winter was, but it snowed into June here. And yes. Oh my God, I had such a hard time getting anything to grow. It snowed all the way into June, and then we had snow in October. So I had a grand total of 3 months where the ground
That's
wasn't
tragic.
frozen. It was really sad. But it's a beautiful sunny day here, and so I'm trying my best to get the grasses out of the garden plot and try to plant some potatoes before it snows again.
I know you're also, in addition to gardening, you're also into foraging. So I have sort of
Yes.
a specific question for myself, and hopefully our
Yeah.
listeners can get something out of this answer too. Because I
Sure.
live in the woods, but I have what I call fear of foraging. It's like I'm terrified because it's like so many things I read are like, this plant looks very similar to this plant. This one is
Yeah.
delicious and full of antioxidants, and this one is absolute deadly poison. So
Yep,
I've done
that's
the
real.
things. There are obvious ones like, you know, wild raspberry bushes and dandelions, like you mentioned, but how do I conquer the fear of foraging without like just devoting my entire life to the study?
Yeah, good question. So, number one, that never goes away. And
Good
number
to know.
two, I don't think that we need it to go away. I think that having a certain level of awareness that the plants can be dangerous is really healthy for us because, there's a certain level of respect that you need to have going out into the woods, and you need to remember that, plants are conscious and they need you to ask their permission. And sometimes if you're not paying very close attention to them, they can trick you. And so, yeah, it's something to keep in mind that it can be very useful, this kind of shadow side of foraging. Remembering that you can't just go out and take everything that you want is very important. So remembering that the plant requires you to get to know them and learn their little idiosyncrasies and be able to tell them apart from other people. It's kind of like, if you remember being a kid and you didn't like it when your mom forgot your name and said every other name in the house before they got to your name. It happens all the time. And of course they know you, but there's something about this knowledge seeking that is very sacred. And so if you're interested in foraging, my usual recommendation is to start real small, start slow, start with things that don't have a poisonous lookalike. So like roses. A rose is a rose is a rose, and rose hips are abundant. Other things that I've, as I was learning, I was like, okay, how do I find like an onion? And the things I was reading is like, well, if it smells like an onion, it's an onion. So you're good. So finding out for yourself, reading a lot, using reputable resources, and that's where a lot of my particular passion comes through is, autonomously and responsibly figuring out stuff for yourself is a really powerful thing. And so learning yourself in a responsible way so that you can become knowledgeable in this way is your best bet whenever you're going to go foraging. And so then getting to know your landscape too. So just going out in the woods and sitting still and looking around you and like, what does that plant look like? What is this doing? What are the patterns that I'm seeing over the years that I'm living here? That kind of thing. And just kind of getting to know it a little bit. All of that can increase your comfort level and also let you get to know things. And then as you delve into it more academically speaking and studying it and getting yourself a really good guidebook, checking yourself against other people. I remember I found a mushroom and I was so excited because I thought it was a reishi, and I wasn't entirely sure. And I was looking it up online and I was like, okay, it could be this, but oh my gosh, it looks so very similar to that, and did I not see it properly? And what if the one next to it looks more like this one? And all these different things. So I put it out on the Instagram and was like, okay, people, I think I found a this thing. What do you think? And I got a couple people responding, and they were like, okay, no, what you found is this. And then I could look that up and like compare it. And so having trusted friends who can help you out with it too is also really important.
Do you have any sources, books, or online otherwise? You don't have to list them now, but if you have something in mind for our listeners, we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I would have to think about that and write them down, I think, because let's see, what do I do? My books that I have, I need to look at them. There's a person who wrote like the book on Montana foraging, and she's on Instagram as well. And she has been a great guide for me. And I'm gonna have to look it up and find her actual name. But she wrote a great book.
But I think that that's an important point, is that it's really important to find people who are kind of local to your area to teach you. If someone teaching me about cactus, a cactus is not going to help me in the woods of Quebec.
Probably not. No. So yeah, the other ones I've always had, like the Peterson guides. Those are really useful for identification, medicinal and herbal foraging. Mosby actually came out with a nursing guidebook for herbs and supplements. Mosby is like the drug book out on the market, and they have one to guide you for those. Because CAM is getting bigger and bigger, and holistic nursing is my specialty. So that's really cool. It's always fun to find like people that you didn't know knew things too. So like this book that I have, and she's very local to Montana, but I had never heard of her before, and she knows everything about the plants for the life of me. I can't remember their name. Yes, I will have to look back through kind of what I'm looking at and let you know better.
Sure, and we'll put it all in the show notes.
Yeah.
So let's jump to something that I read on your page, and I'll let you respond to it. Witches were nurses once and continue. I'll let you giggle so I can get it out.
Yeah, sorry.
Witches were nurses once and continue to carry the torch for integrating the art and the science of healing. What does that mean?
That's the big topic area. I will try to bring it down to like a couple sentences. So the first thing I usually recommend for reading, or for this first part, the first part of the sentence was "witches were nurses once." Barbara Ehrenreich, and yeah, you're nodding.
Deirdre
Yep,
English, yeah.
Deirdre English wrote this amazing book, "Witches, Nurses, and Midwives,"
And
and
for our listeners, you've heard me talk about this book, I think, in many several episodes. I'm gonna, again, as I always do, there's a free PDF. Please buy the book, but if you can't
please.
afford it, then just click on the PDF that I'm gonna put in the show notes. Go
Yeah.
ahead, Ravi.
Yeah, so witches were nurses once. We know from history that there were medicinal women and wise women who would fit into what we call a nurse, who were the ones that knew about how to take care of yourself, how to take care of other people, and how to integrate your world into your healing. So with plants, but also, spirituality and a lot of different things. Currently, in our contemporary sort of iteration of this wise woman, we find it mostly in the field of nursing. It's very, very evident in this field. And that's because the praxis of nursing really rests on the idea that the individual is their best healer, and it takes an integration of, just like in ancient times and ancient ways of doing things, just like we always used to understand, an integration of the spiritual and the physical and the mental all together. There's no separation of these things. And all of these things together create what we know of as, well, actually what we don't know of as health, because we often think of health as just this absence of disease symptoms. And we don't really have a good definition for what health means. And in nursing, because the field is patient-centered, patient-focused, collaborative with the patient, and understands that healing cannot occur without the individual itself being part of the process, it really reckons back to a lot of the ways that medicine used to be before its colonization and appropriation and made into a capitalist venture.
And again, listeners, if you want to hear more about this, please read Witches, Midwives, and Nurses. Yes. And yes. It's a quick read. Everybody, please. It's like so short and it's so amazing. And it's like, as the first time I read it, my mother was a registered nurse. I finished it and I immediately just sent her a copy.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I sent one to my sister, like every woman I know. Now.
Yeah. It's amazing. They pack so much cool stuff into a short period. And honestly, I'd recommend reading literally anything that the two of them have written together. I know that I referred to them extensively in my last paper. Also Sylvia Federici. I can't start a conversation about medical history without talking about her. She writes similar things. And you know, it's one of the reasons why the topic becomes so big so quickly, is because it has more to do with just what's best for a person and what you want to be doing for your own personal health. It has to do with the business of healthcare and the capitalist side of it all, and the fact that there are a lot of things that they don't want you to do because they can't make money off of it if you do it that way. And, you know, a lot of people might have an initial reaction to that statement of, what a conspiracy theorist, or, oh my God, what a feminist joy kill. It's based in a lot of research and a lot of evidence that we know that this is the case, and we know that this is kind of what we're up against right now, is that healing and health and being healthy in our current society is very, very difficult to obtain. And so what I've written about is this idea that it's something saleable. There's an idea of health that someone wants to sell you. But because of this capitalist culture that we live in, you're never going to actually obtain it, because then they would lose their entire consumer base. So this picture of health, which, by the way, is a white male with money, picture of health that all of our research is based off of. I remember I reached out to you after White Feather Hunter's interview, because this is what she was talking about. And
we actually made the great White Feather Hunter.
God, yes. We made contact, and I was just like gushing. I was like, oh, you're amazing.
White Feather is amazing. Be it resolved.
Yes, yes. So, you know, these are the things that we were talking about, where what she's saying from what she's written about is, you know, this picture of health it's always based on the male model, down to the genes that we're studying. We always use the male as the template. And so in healthcare as a business, as a woman, for instance, or as a woman of color, or as a woman who is just not doing things in the same way that everybody else wants you to do them, you're very much considered unhealthy. There's, you know, the Adrienne Marie Brown, who wrote, you know, The Body Is Not an Apology, she's doing some of this work with, you know, pleasure activism and stuff, and this whole like adipositivity movement is a great example of health comes in every form and every size, and it doesn't have to necessarily be this like thin, really athletic person, you know. So it's one of the really encouraging things about what's going on right now, is that there's a lot of discussion about the different types of health and different pictures of health and ways that we can be healthy and not necessarily have to strive towards this impossible ideal, that doesn't really exist, and stop pouring your money into it, basically.
This is making me think of a couple of the hashtags that I've seen you use that made me really super excited. So yeah. Let me throw a couple out and you can dissect them for me, okay?
Okay.
Hashtag resistance medicine.
Yes. Resistance medicine. That's something I picked up from seeing it elsewhere. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. This is encapsulates exactly what I want to be saying. Medicine. And so let's first of all define what medicine is. So the official definition of medicine that we legally must attend to in order to not get in trouble is the purview of doctors, medical doctors, and people that are licensed in that field. So we need to make sure that I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about medicine in the kind of more global sense of something that you would do that's good for you. Not necessarily a pill that you take. So to put those two words together, resistance medicine is what you need to feel good and to be healthy in a way that you have determined you would like to be. Not necessarily what somebody else has told you have to be. So to do the sort of healing work in yourself and finding the medicines and kind of the larger sense of the word that work for you is a form of resistance against the colonizing tactics of a predatory consumerist kind of healthcare system. So resistance medicine, yeah, it's what do you need to feel good? What do you need to be healthy? How do you want to do this? How do you want to move through the world as an individual? Do that.
Perfect. And what about anarcho-herbalism? I had never seen this word before, and I was like, oh my God, that makes me feel really excited. What's anarcho-herbalism?
That word got me kicked off of Facebook, like banned from Facebook. Yeah.
Is it the anarcho part?
They don't like that word. So there's some very interesting movements. Very interesting sort of fields of thought around anarchy and around what it really means and around how we could do medicine and healing better. Anarcho-herbalism, which I have an APA citation for it, actually. Anarcho-herbalism is something that I found a few years ago when I was writing my last paper, and it really encapsulated the way that I feel about the healthcare system, about the medical system. So the first part being anarchy. Anarchy, contrary to popular belief and demonization, is this idea that people are doing things that are for good. They're doing things in what is good for them, but not in the commonly misunderstood self-interested kind of way. They're doing things that they know that they need to do to be happy and healthy and well-rounded. But they also have this greater interest of what is good for everybody, sort of in that's kind of encapsulated in the definition as well. And again, not in the way that we see a lot of it utilized in toxic systems where it's like, well, the greater good, meaning this tiny group of people over here that want it this way. And so everyone else gets sacrificed. It's not like that. So I would say if you're interested in finding out more about it, you should probably do a little more, not you, the global you.
No, me too. Yes.
Doing some more research into what the tenets are underlying this sort of, this anarchist sort of idea of the world. It's a way of thinking about population and people and communities as an ever evolving self-regulating type of system that doesn't necessarily need a ruling class to tell people what to do. And so what I love about it is that it rejects the very popular belief that all people are inherently bad. It rejects that entirely. And it's like, no, actually, whenever people are allowed to be in community and and have the resources they need instead of being driven into scarcity, actually people are really good, and we can live together in a very healthy way if we did not have specific power structures that are causing these unnatural pressures on our choice making. So that work combined with herbalism, the idea that all knowledge about plants and healing and your body should be for everyone. So a very important part of this kind of anarchist mindset is that knowledge and knowledge is the best word for it, I guess, that knowledge is not something to be sequestered by a tiny group of individuals. Knowledge about your body, about the world, about plants, about, you know, the ways that the two can interact, that is not for sale. That's not something that should be kept secret until you can pay your way into the club. So anarcho-herbalism is about the free exchange of ideas for people to understand about plants and their healing properties. So if you know something about a plant, or you found this thing that works, you don't patent it and then sell it and make a profit off of it. You share the knowledge, you share the plants, you understand that property is an entirely constructed meaning, and it doesn't exist. So, you know, it's just a different way of thinking about things and healing. A lot, you know, an anarcho-herbalist would probably buck at the idea of having to buy a book about herbalism, because this should just be common knowledge. It should just be things that people share with each other, because this is for everyone, because the world is for everyone. Anarcho-herbalism is kind of that in a nutshell. But there is a cool sort of stream of ideas around it that kind of are building up what that means and how you could actually utilize it in the world.
And how about our listeners who live in urban areas? You and I both do not live in urban areas. We're very lucky that way. But how can they sort of begin to or expand their understanding of a connection to plant medicine?
That is something that has come up a lot lately, actually, especially with the recent, the pandemic, and people are thinking like, wow, I need to kind of get a hold of my supply chain. And how can I do that when I live in an apartment three stories up with no ground to put things in? And it's an opportunity for us to find creative new ways to be, instead of panicking and shutting down and going, oh, it's hopeless. It's a great opportunity for us to become something new. So there's a lot of resources that are coming up because this is a big question. And I've seen a bunch of them on Instagram and on some other places about how to do this. So for one thing, you could try, if you have like a porch area, or if you have an area where you just get some good sunlight, you can try potted plants, and even just picking one or two kind of herbs that you know that you like to use and that you want to get to know better, and growing them in the house is a great way to just connect to the plant itself and also get to know what is it like to care for something that requires your interaction to live. And how does your presence sort of affect it? And, you know, if you're, I have a lot of friends that I work with, and they're like, oh my gosh, no, I kill plants. Like I can never keep a plant alive. And I'm like, you know, I actually thought that about myself at one point, and I decided that I did not want to do that. And I wanted to be able to have an indoor plant and not kill it. But it took a lot of learning. It took a lot of sitting there with the plant and studying it and going, you're yellow. Why are you yellow? What's the matter? What's wrong with you that you're yellow? And what am I doing to make you yellow? It's a really interesting reflective process.
Because I think people think that like plants are like, I don't know, throw this in the microwave and press start. But yeah, it's more like learning to play a piano.
Yeah.
You know, like you wouldn't expect to get it right the first time.
No. You never do. And it's another learning process, because right now we're living in a culture that's so fixated on perfectionism. And I was just thinking about this morning, and because I submitted a manuscript and they said no thanks, and I was like, oh God, that hurts. And then I was like, man, I know that I am a good writer. Like, I know I love writing, but it's, why do I feel like I have to be a child prodigy in order to be validated as a good writer? And it was like, oh, there's a perfectionism again. Crap. I don't want to do that to myself. And so we have this idea that, we have to be good at everything, and especially in our social media culture where we feel like we're watched all the time by everybody. And if you're not doing it great, then why are you doing it at all? That's so toxic. So with plants, they're so forgiving in most cases, where they can teach you about themselves. And if you're willing to sort of go, I'm going to learn something new, I'm not going to be good at it right away, but I'm going to keep trying. That's the magic. So you can do the potted plants, and there's really cool books about like vertical gardening. If you have a small space and you can plant something in the ground and you can let it grow high, you can do container boxes. You can do hydroponic gardening. There's all kinds of resources for non-traditional type of growing things. And what I also like to do is you figure out what might grow best in your area. So like we've got it's the high desert here. It's really arid and dry. Succulents grow amazing here. I have a ton of them now because they love it and they just pop. So finding out what plants want to be your friend is a good way to go about, you know, trying to just start with one. Start with one little plant. Make friends with it. Give it a name. See what you can find out about yourself.
Those of you who follow us on Instagram have seen my journey of the green onion, the miraculous journey of the green onion. That has been blowing my mind. Like, I'm trying to learn about plants. I really am just a beginner. So for me, that was like a legitimate miracle to watch this thing regenerate itself. They're like the vampires of the onion world. It's just like you close your eyes and they're back.
It's amazing. I've regrown green onions, I think, 3 or 4 times in just some water. They're not the only ones that do that. You can do that with celery, with onions. Mm-hmm. I want to say carrots, definitely potatoes. If you've ever taken a potato out and you're like, what is the tubery thing on this? It's going to be a plant. It wants to be a plant. Cut it out, cut the little eye out and stick it in, you know, some hydroponic solution and see if you can grow another potato. It'd be so cool. That's been one of my experimenting areas as well, is to see what things can I grow back from stuff I bought at the store. My whole goal is to have all of my vegetables come from my own garden. And so I've been learning the Montana environment and getting better at it. And now I've got this community garden plot, which is what I was digging through whenever we started the call. And it's huge. And I'm going to put all these plants in it and I'm really excited about it. But you know, last year my experiment was, what did I buy at the store that I can regrow, and would it regrow, and would it create a fruit? Because if you are learning about plants, you might be hearing about how like Monsanto puts in this terminator gene whenever they're developing their plants. Basically, there's a lot of patents out on seeds right now. And if you're interested at all in the political landscape about this, the International Seed Savers is a great place to start, where there's patents on all of these seeds and all of this food that will preclude people from growing it unless they purchase it. And it's, they're also making it so that these plants in a lot of cases won't make more food. They're a one
they
and done.
Sort of like they're like their DNA has like a self-destruct button in it.
Basically. It does. Yeah. That's the Terminator gene. They've spliced in this gene that once they reproduce, then they die. They're messing with the whole sacred cycle of plants, and they're privatizing our natural world. It's really scary. And so if you're interested in ecological activism, it's a little niche that I feel like not a lot of people know about, but once you start learning about it, you're like, whoa, that's intense. That's a lot. I didn't know that was happening in a lot of cases. It's quite insidious. So, one of my ideas was I want to see if this is happening in my food. What am I eating? And so I did successfully regrow some tomatoes and some potatoes that had been bought just at a regular supermarket. And I was really excited about that. I just got some heirloom tomatoes from the store the other day. And I was like, I'm saving your seeds. I'm going to see if you grow. Let's see what happens. It's a lot of fun.
I love that. So our platform is your platform. What is your like grand message to the missing witches out there, to the coven?
Oh my gosh. And you know, I was kind of thinking about this and trying to figure out, I knew you were going to ask me this, and I was like, yeah, wow, I don't.
I like big, hard, impossible to answer questions.
Yes. I'm sure that I'll come around to a very profound single sentence here after I babble for a minute. So let me just babble through my thoughts. My biggest passion point, I would say, the thing that I write about, the thing that I teach, and the thing that I do as a nurse and as a yoga teacher and as just a person in the world is that you are your own final authority on everything in your life. There is absolutely no person or system or institution that gets to tell you who you are, what you do, or what you should be doing. Not a damn one of them. The minute you figure that out, you're a witch. the second that clicks in your brain, you are unfucking touchable. You are an absolutely unstoppable force in your own life. And that, more than anything else, is what I want for people to find in themselves. I want my daughter to learn that. I want for my friends that I come into contact to see that in me and to be like, whoa, I totally can do that too. It's constant work though. It's constant. So I don't want to set myself up as like, oh no, I have everything figured out, because I don't. Mm-mm. But you know, we started this conversation with me saying like, oh my God, what am I even doing with my life? And that brings me back to that sort of, because A, you know, the shoulds of the world were going to tell you a lot of things, and you can't pay attention to those because those are going to drive you nuts and take you down a path that you never really wanted to be on. And then B, if you think about your life as, what do you want to do? What do you like doing? Literally at the next moment in your life, is that making you happy? And if not, get rid of it. If you can, there are limits, I'm sure. Sure. But you know, it's very much up to you. It's very much your own book that you're writing, and no one else gets to be the author. So you should write your own story. And I remember I got kind of on this track in my mind after reading the Four Agreements. And I read it when I was in like high school or early college. And I remember him saying, you don't have to agree with what people think about you. And it blew my actual mind. I stopped and I thought about it, and I was like, oh my God, whoa, well, then what do I think about myself? And, you know, set me on this whole journey of, you know, stop listening to what other people are telling you. You can do it. So when it comes to my particular areas of things like herbalism and plants and healing, my teaching points always revolve around this idea of autonomy. And if what you're doing is really what you want to be doing. I used to teach a chronic disease self-management class when I was in working in public health. And it was a really, really cool class. I loved teaching it. And the thing that they taught, whenever you go to make goals and whenever you go to think about how you want to be healthy, you have to think about it from what you want. If you're going to do it because someone else has told you that you should do it this way, research has shown that you are not going to stick to that. If your doctor tells you you have to take this medication and they don't really, you know, like talk to you much about why, because that happens a lot, you're probably not going to do it because you don't know how it's really benefiting you. But if you are able to understand more about the system that you're working with in your own body that the medication is supposed to affect and the doctor, like why he, you think that they need to, that you need to take this medicine and all these things. And then you decide through your own sort of knowledge gathering process that, okay, that is a benefit. I like that. I'm going to do it. I think that's going to make my life better. Then you will actually take that medication. It's when you think about it, you're like, well, of course, it's common sense, but it's really hard to do. And so again, a lot of my research really revolves around the female body in the sense of like what the medical system has termed the female body, those of us with a uterus. And again, Sylvia Federici, Barbara Ehrenreich, Deirdre English, there's tons and tons and tons of authors that can tell you about the historical methods of controlling this particular part of the body and why. I started looking into how we make choices in our system and why we make these particular choices. And so what is influencing our, whether or not we feel like we have power in our own bodies. And what I found was that there's just all of these discourses, all of these lines of information that are coming at us that are telling you what you should be like and how you should be behaving. And so again, yeah, I'm just starting to ramble. So what am I trying to say? Autonomous decision-making comes when you have all the information and no coercion. That's the definition of it. And that is impossible.
Let me just repeat that. All the information and no coercion.
Yes.
All the information and no coercion. That sounds like a like capital G goal.
Yes. So having all the information and not feeling like you're being pressured in any particular direction, then you're making autonomous decisions. If you don't have information and you have a lot of pressure from these other lines of people that have an interest in your choice, they have some money to make off of you for choosing a particular thing, for instance, that's not an autonomous choice. And so when it comes to health, you should be very interested in who's telling you things, what they're telling you, why they're telling you that, and how it is going to play out in your body and in your life. And if it's not in your best interest and you don't feel like you can make an autonomous decision, then you need to pause and evaluate that situation. Sometimes there's some blind trust that goes into it. So, you know, as a nurse and working in the Western healthcare system, there is times where you're just like, I don't have time right now to tell you exactly what's going on. Please trust me. I have your best interest in mind. And that's why, you know, we take all these oaths about doing no harm, because that on the individual level, I do believe that most people who got into the medical fields really, really care. And most of us really, really want the best for our patients. And so there's not always time for us to be like, you know, let me tell you all about these things that we could do for your heart while you're having a heart attack.
It's just not practical.
Yeah, no, please just trust me. You're having a heart attack and let's talk about it later. But, you know, nursing, again, takes into that idea of the patient is part of the healthcare decision-making team. And so even in the middle of an emergency, we want you to feel like you have some control here and we're not just working on your body because, you know, you're an inert piece of equipment. We're interacting with you on the human level. It's super complicated, convoluted. And I love it.
We don't shy away from the complicated around these parts. That's for sure.
Yeah. There's differentiations to make between like what the system is doing and what the individual is doing. That's a whole other bag of worms. So in a systemic sort of sense, whenever you're trying to make a decision, that seeking of knowledge and that also the voicing of your own experience are really important. There's been this movement in medicine, well, in the patient side of medicine lately, about the patient being the best, the most knowledgeable about their experience. You find in chronic diseases and in a lot of trauma and different things like that, that the people are coming up with these stories about how their doctors didn't believe them. And then like, you know, they had to go and figure it out for themselves. And that's tragic. It's a failure of our system. And it's also amazing that these people are putting this out there and letting you know that you can figure it out and you are smart enough to know this about yourself. And if someone's not listening to you, go find someone who will. If you have that privilege and you have that ability, you know, don't stop until someone takes you seriously. And that's a really important part of the autonomous sort of process is, you know, trusting your own voice, trusting your own body's wisdom, and figuring out for yourself what's going to work best in partnership with these other people that are trying to help you as well. There's a lot to be said about the integration of these kind of sometimes what seems like competing sort of discourses. We've got, you know, the doctor side that says we know best, and you have like this the patient activist side that's going, in a lot of the cases. And what I strive to do as someone who kind of straddles both sides of the fence, the CAM and the witch, sorry, I say CAM and I don't know if you know what that is, complementary and alternative medicine. So like CAM and witch and herbalism and all these things. And then also I work in an acute care setting in a hospital where it's very Western and it's very, very scientifically rigorous. At first glance, they look like they're opposing, but I think that our work as people who want for the best for everyone and we want to make the world a better place is to say, you know, it's not either or, we need a both and let's work on both and. So it's both these amazing, amazing things that we do with medicine. Such cool stuff. There's things that go on in the hospital that I'm like, that is science fiction. That can't be real, but it's real. And you're just like, wow, that's cool. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this other side where you're talking about plants and they have consciousness and how they can interact with the body. And that's amazing as well. That's science fiction as well. You know, there's wonder and there's magic to be had in both sides. And bringing the two together to work with each other is going to get us way further than either of us standing on one side of the fence going, no, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. That doesn't get us anywhere.
Listening is so key. Listening is so key. And that's why intersectional everything is the best possible version of everything.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I really, really, am grateful that that word has gotten more popular. I was reflecting on like TV before and after 2016.
Oh.
And like before we had such visible hate, we sort of just kept playing along like it was like nothing was a big deal. There, you know, nothing was really at stake. And then this happened, and suddenly it was like, all right, no, now y'all are gonna listen. Now we're putting everything out there, and that's not okay anymore, and this is why, and we're not just playing along. It's been really, really cool to see. I never thought that the words that I learned in my graduate program for feminist studies, I have a graduate certificate in that, I never thought that those words that I was using in these papers were going to be common everyday language on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. I like the first time I saw that happen, I nearly fell over. I was like, holy crap. Yes, ma'am.
This language is going mainstream.
It's mainstream and it's happening. And it's really cool to see. It's really helped to empower me as well. Cause I, like I mentioned, you know, the feminist killjoy, label. I have been called the ISIS of feminism. You know, I've done a lot of my own internal work because I did get an academic degree in it, and it was very privileged and very white feminism. And so all of this conversation that's come up, I've been like, oh, that makes sense. Yes, I'm going to adjust that in my life. Thank you. And it's been really cool to go through that growth process and to see that growth process in other people and our sort of everyday kind of discourses. It's been really cool. And I am, I'm very grateful for all the voices and the voices that are also saying, we're not going to teach you, go look it up. And then you do. And then you're just like, wow, that's a whole world that I didn't know existed. And just the learning process is cool. So like you're saying with the listening, I have an author, a teacher that I really appreciate, Tara Brock.
Was that Tara or Kara?
Tara with a T.
With a T. Thank you.
Tara Brock. She wrote Radical Acceptance. And she's written a ton of stuff, but that book changed my life. Absolutely. She writes about becoming curious and the process of change, not necessarily like that being your goal, but the process of acceptance through curiosity. So with yourself and with other people, instead of seeing something and automatically putting up your walls and, you know, oh, I know what that is and labeling it. And so I'm going to either engage or disengage or judge that. Because I think I know everything about it. Instead of doing those things, you just have sort of an open curiosity about what could this teach me? And when we do that with each other, the world changes because we're suddenly not super self-interested in our own protection. We are being a little vulnerable and allowing space for things to be different than we thought they were going to be. And one of her reasons for talking about that is because that is what truly alleviates suffering. Whenever we let go of the things that we think are concretized in our life and we sort of get to know them a little bit better and we're open to that change, then we're not suffering anymore because we're not holding on to these ideas that are causing pain. I'm not doing this description justice. I highly recommend reading anything she's written.
We'll put some links in the show notes, and I know yes. I am going to go and read some Tara Brock as soon as hang up here.
She's got an amazing podcast too.
It's called
What is it called? I don't know the title of it, but if you just look her up. Like she's
Tara
the only
Brock,
one.
Everybody. Yeah. And I'll find it and we'll link it in the show notes for sure.
Okay. Yeah. I listen to her a lot. Especially mornings going into work and getting ready to work a 12-hour shift. She just is, it's a really cool way of sort of shifting your thinking a little bit and bringing some compassionate change to some painful situations. It's really cool.
So I think that this kind of relates to, I think you and I share a role model.
Yeah.
And so maybe you could answer this as a final question and then we'll sign off. Why do all of our listeners and Coven members and everyone in the world immediately need to go and tonight watch Harold and Maude?
Oh, yes. I love her. I love everything about that movie. Yeah, okay. Oh, reason number one, the music.
Cat Stevens.
His song, If You Want to Sing Out, Sing Out, is like my anthem. I love it. Number two, she's the character that you and I are talking about is Maude, even though the main character could be argued to be Harold. Maude is just everything that a divine female, divine person could be. She's absolutely belongs to herself, and she is totally free in her world because of that. She has lived through horrible things and has seen the worst of humanity, and yet she still is open and loving and curious enough that she finds this random person and is just like, dude, let's be friends, you look cool. And and she teaches without even trying to teach. And so, like, the story itself of the kid that can't find a reason to live, and then finding this person who kind of frees him from that suffering, that's one part of it, but that is not what the movie's actually about. It's about Maude, and she is everything I want to be. She is the most passionate, loving, kind, and amazing character that I can think of. The movie itself, I feel like we should put a little disclaimer, is the movie itself can be a little shocking.
A little triggering if you don't. Yeah, definitely. But it softens. I think it opens kind of harshly and then it softens immediately. So yeah.
Yes.
Be careful for the first 5 minutes or so. They can be a little triggering.
But I actually that movie ended up being my litmus test for partners. It wasn't intentional. I just, like, one boyfriend that I had, I put on Harold and Maude one day because I was like, I love this movie, I want you to watch it with me. And he was like, oh God, no, I don't like that at all. And I was like, all right, well, this is not going to work out.
No way.
And it didn't. Like, 3 months later, we had broken up, and I was just like, that's for the best.
I find Maude, like I said, like, to be such an incredible role model. One of my favorite parts is, again, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, so I'm going to keep it as vague as possible. She creates a work of art, and someone tells her that he doesn't like her work of art that she has created. And instead of being upset, Maude says, that's okay. Artistic appreciation takes time.
Yes.
Implying that it's not her work. It's that he is not at a high enough level to be able to appreciate the
fine. I think
Gil Hurston, she kind of said the same thing. Like, she can't understand why anyone would want to not have the pleasure of her company. So yeah, Maude as role model.
I love her. I think everyone should try to aspire to be Maude. And I know when I was growing up, my mom is the one who had us watch this movie. I think I watched it for the first time I was in middle school. And you know, one of Maude's final sort of lines where, you know, how do I do this without spoilers? Spoilers ahead. skip if you don't want the movie spoiled. Mm-hmm. When Harold says he loves her and she's dying, and she goes, That's wonderful. Go out and love some more.
Now
and
go
like,
love some more.
Oh my God. Just, oh, how beautiful. It's never the end. There's not an end. There's not a finality to things that makes it so that you can't love anymore. It just keeps going.
And the idea of possessions when they have that, like, again, skip, skip, skip. If you haven't seen this movie, skip, skip, skip. Yeah, the amusement park coin.
Yeah.
Gives it to her, and it's this beautiful, loving gift that he gives to her, and she takes it and
throws it away.
And he, of course, he's shocked, and Maude is like, now I'll always know where it is.
Yeah, I remember not understanding that scene when I was a kid, and like, but now she doesn't have it anymore. And my mom was just like, it's not the thing, it's the gesture. And she was a really cool teacher because she would say, like, we would be worried that someone would steal something of ours. And she goes, if somebody steals something, it means they need it more than you do. And she kind of brought that back up where she was just like, it's not the thing. The thing is not where the love is. It's the gesture and it's the person and it's the moment. And that was a really cool teaching moment. My favorite part of the movie, though, I think, whenever he first comes to her house and you see it, and I, like, when I was, like, in high school, I was like, oh, that's my future. Cool.
A train car out in the middle of nowhere filled with musical instruments. And
full of stuff. And she says, you know, the trick to a healthy life is to greet the dawn with a breath of fire. And so when I started to study yoga, I found in Kundalini, that's a real thing.
Yes.
And I was just like, my God, she's a wise person. That movie is like so layered. Like,
you know, Maude
answers
is
every last question.
Yeah. Maude is fictional, but she is very, very real to me.
Yes.
Very, very
real. I love it so
real.
Much.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Lest this become the Harold and Maude podcast eventually, let's go back to anarcho-herbalism. Tie that in a digestible bow for our listeners who are, like myself, are hearing this term and are like, this is something I want to know more about.
Yeah. Okay. In a digestible bow.
Good luck.
You have a right to knowledge. And you have a right to know what's going on with your body and to make decisions about your body and what you put into your body for healing. The right to knowledge includes the world around you and the plants and the medicine that you want to know about. Now, I'm going to put a caveat on that because there are traditions of medicine in plant work that you must respect as not your own or as something that you should ask permission to know about. I'm talking specifically about like indigenous methods. Absolutely, especially as a white person myself, I've been towing the line and trying to figure out how do I fit into wanting to learn about this type of thing. And it is not my right to just barge in and go, hey, I want to know. So with the caveat of humility and of asking permission and of knowing that you absolutely have to deconstruct your privilege and a settler mindset in order to go into this work, you can't go into it charging around going, I have a right to know, tell me things. You can't do that. Anarcho-herbalism is saying that there is a sacredness to the world that we're all part of. And we all have an inherent right to be here and to interact with that sacred knowledge to the extent that we can. So it's primarily talking about, you know, I see these like ads for supplements and people that are like, it's from the Amazonian jungle and it's supposed to make you live forever and look like a newborn child. That's absolute bullshit. It's horrible. For one thing, if you have to pay gads of money for it, it's just a business scheme. All right, I'm thinking. It's more about responsibility of the self. You do have the right to knowledge, and you have a responsibility to move through the world responding in a in a curious and open way. Let's say it that way.
Something
this is hard
complex for the little bow, and yeah. And I always feel like I'm trapping people into trying to explain
I don't astronomical
no. concepts and in disposable packages.
No. I don't feel like it's trapped. I feel like I want to do justice to the concept without being too so general that I'm gonna do harm, because there's a lot to it. So the digestible bow is that this is a complex issue and it is multifaceted and layered, and it has a lot to do with deconstructing the current way that we go about doing things in the world. So if you're interested in it, approaching it with an attitude of humility and an attitude of learning and curiosity, and knowing that you have, you know, your autonomous self, you have this the sacred right to be here and the sacred right to know about yourself. And if you choose to utilize herbs and to learn about them and to ask other people for their teaching, that you do so from that center of humility. You're also responsible for going back out and teaching people what you know and sharing that, and not necessarily just holding it to yourself and you know, with businesses, they find something and they patent it and then they want to sell it. And I'm like, I realize that we all need to make peace with the fact that we have to have money right now, but you know, it, health and healing and methods of healing and just the way that you can access those things, those should be things that we all can have. It shouldn't be something where, you know, we have this healthcare system where we've got these amazing things that can be done and amazing healing that can be done, and only a tiny percentage of people can actually afford to do it. Anarcho-herbalism says that is true harm. That is the definition of evil. It's, you know, there should not be a situation where somebody can't get what they need. Because in an anarchist sort of context, you are doing things so that your needs are met in a responsible way. It's much too large of a concept to boil down to just one or two words, you know, a couple of sentences. I would say go look for it, find things that speak to you about it, learn about it, approach it an attitude of curiosity and seeing what you can learn and what you want to keep about it and what you're like, maybe that's not for me. Like, maybe you like the herbalism part, but you're like, anarchy still kind of makes me uncomfortable. Cool. Do you, you know, it's all good. It's a really cool thing that will, you know, it takes time. I'm still learning about it and deconstructing my own ways of thinking about things and, you know, incorporating it in some ways, and in other ways I'm like, well, maybe not that part, and that's part of the process too,
and that's okay. We don't need to be fundamentalists about anything. No. Really,
no
good.
I really, really hope that I was able to encapsulate through my rambling sort of the ideas. They are so big, I would hate it if somebody like went out and tried to look it up and was just like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard and that's so harmful and how could she say that? I'm like, oh god, that's not what I meant.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, I personally, I'm collecting perspectives one at a time, and I think we're all very clear that, like, this is your perspective, this is my perspective. Anyone who's listening to this podcast, I hope, has enough critical analysis to be able to work through things. And again, if someone is listening, and I've been called out before, and pretty much every person that's ever like written to me and said, I think you're wrong about this, I've invited to be on the show. That's so cool. Like, never worry about being wrong is just an opportunity for me. I'm like, oh, I'm wrong. Good. I got proven wrong today. Yeah. Like, I grew and I learned.
Yeah. That is how I felt. Whenever the deconstruction of all the white feminism stuff started really coming up. And I very much was like, it was very threatening to me. I felt it. And I was like, okay, opportunity to learn, not react here. And my God, that's an everyday sort of thing for me that I'm so grateful for, because I know that I'm becoming a better person by thinking through these things instead of just going, oh no, that doesn't feel right. No, I'm not doing that.
I have a special trick that I use to like counter my own white feminist defensiveness. Yeah. And that is, anytime it starts to bubble up and I start to feel that white feminist defensiveness coming up, I say to myself, how do you feel when you see hashtag not all men, hashtag right. all lives matter? Aww. And then you want to puke, right? And so I want to puke at myself after I think about that when I get defensive. Like, you know, it's hard to hear a criticism of yourself and to say, yeah, you're right. Yeah. But I mean, I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. I mean,
we're all just trying our best.
And I'm big into like, get into your imperfections. You talked about the vulnerability. Like, let's dig into our imperfections. If you have a hump, throw some glitter on it. That's mine.
Right? There's some cool witchy talk about like your shadow side and the dark goddess and all those things. I just either got or put on my wish list a book that was talking about that. And I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah. How can we find our strength in the places that we've traditionally rejected? Like, how can we do that? There's a lot of cool stuff coming up around that too.
Yeah. And one of the things that I found is that when I admit to my own faults or my own shortcomings or my own, you know, I don't like the word failure because it, you know, if I've learned something, then a failure doesn't exist. But when I talk about my own vulnerabilities, I see people physically relax.
Yeah, for sure.
When I do that. So to me, it's like a superpower. Like by admitting this about yourself, you can, like you were saying, like you want to be that role model. You want people to look at you and say, if they can do that, I can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I like that a lot. And there's a there's really cool academic discourse around the concept of failure and not necessarily reclaiming that, but using the label of failure to point out very important things about these systems and what we're talking about. And failure being like, oh, you didn't do it right. Well, the way that you have it set up is flawed, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's definitely like unsettling, this like colonial linear method of like quote unquote progress, you know. So to like revel in the failures is definitely unsettling work, I think.
It is disruptive. It's really, really cool disruption for sure. I've been trying to kind of figure out how I want to do, so, you know, I have the Sovereign Health Project as my business, and it was herbalism for a minute, but then as I was looking into like all the FDA restrictions and stuff, I was just like, okay, never mind, just forget it. So that's when I got rid of that Instagram, because I wanted to kind of have a clean slate, and I was like, I'm changing the direction of it. I've turned it more into general education where I can write about this stuff, but also an invitation that if you were wanting to utilize having someone who's a nurse, like as a one-on-one sort of discussion about health and yoga and how like these things can, you can use these things in your life to heal yourself. I created a Patreon for that. And there's not a lot on it yet, but if you wanted to tell people that they could seek that if they wanted to, I'm still sort of putting information on it and building it. That's my, like, I guess life slash career goal, I would say, is to combining these, the holistic side of nursing with the scientific side, with the yoga, kind of all together into, you know, working one-on-one with people if they wanted to.
Can you just rattle off your links right now so that
we have so the Patreon is, patreon.com/besovereign.
B-E and then the word sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then my Instagram, I'm usually posting, when I do post, I post things about, kind of that healing mentality and the autonomy mentality. But those are my main two things right now.
Sorry, you never said your handle. What's your handle?
Oh, then I am the Nurse Witch.
Bon.
Yes. And so I'm still kind of building offerings. I'm trying to figure out Instagram TV and how to put yoga on that. Once I do start getting patrons, I want to offer like a monthly sort of newsletter or yoga sequence that they could have. I would say if you do seek out that information, please be patient with me as it is a work in progress. But I would love it if people could also tell me what they want. And then, you know, if they come on the page and they're like, man, I'm really looking for this kind of thing. Like, sweet. Let me add that. That would be really cool. I love the conversation and the finding out what people need to heal. And then if I have it in my bag of tricks, my nursing cauldron, then I would love to work with you on that.
So what's the best way for people to reach you? Is Instagram the best way? Like slide into your DMs at the Nurse Witch. There are no dots, no underscores, no dashes. At the Nurse Witch.
Yep. Yeah. Hit me up. I would love to talk to you about all these cool witchy things.
Awesome. Thank you again so much. Let's sing ourselves out. Okay. I'm going to start and join in. Ready?
Okay.
Well, if you want to sing out.
And if you want to be free, be free.
Because there's a million
ways to be.
You must be a witch.